Coming up next, WWER presents Your Care Partners, a show dedicated to providing support and education to our community about caregiving. Just know you're not alone, 'cause I'm gonna make this place your home. Experienced professional caregivers Jill White and Marty Allman have casual conversations about care, offering advice and tips to help navigate caring for others. Jill White is a certified dementia practitioner and an Alzheimer's Association facilitator for caregiver support groups with over 30 years' experience working in long-term care. Marty Allman is certified as a master trainer for the Best Friends approach to Alzheimer's. She is a certified psychiatric nursing assistant with over 20 years' experience working in long-term care.
WWER 88.1 FM. I'm Marty Allman.
And I'm Jill White.
And we are your care partners. Today, we have a special guest,
Tina Thomas. Tina, introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about you, your background, and what you're doing currently, please.
Perfect. My name is Dr. Tina Thomas. I have been working in Health and Human Services now for 35 plus years. I am the executive director at the Martha W. Goodson Center in Williamsburg, a division within Riverside Health System.
Fantastic. We've all been in this business for a while, some of us a little longer than others, but I can't believe you got 35 years in. Heavens to Betsy. Anyway, so we decided, based on what we talked about briefly, to touch on some of the topics that are concerning to you and the services that you provide. And we can just kind of go down the little bullet mark list that we did about the, you know, historical opportunities and or resources that are not available for, let's say, people of color.
Mm-hmm. There's a national awareness opportunity to support and or recognize some of the successes and or challenges that people of color in our country have faced. One of those are inequities as it relates to health and human services. Dementia is not uncommon in the African-American community. Most would be surprised to know that African-Americans are almost two times more likely to be impacted by Alzheimer's disease than our Caucasian counterparts, particularly older African-Americans. Latinas are about 1.5 times more likely to be impacted by dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And you know, we really don't know quite why that happens. There are some theories out there, but they are still trying to explore those. What we do know is that African-Americans in the United States have a totally different experience with Alzheimer's.
Tina? Tina, are you there?
Yes.
Tina, I am so sorry. We dropped you again. You were telling us about, obviously, the inequity and the historically the huge difference in percentages of African-Americans and Latinas with the disease.
Yes.
But how does that trickle down to the type of care and or resources that are available or reach out to them?
Historically, in Black and Brown communities, families really rallied around and stepped up and supported one another. It's more challenging today than it was 20 years ago because families are spread out in a way that they were not spread out 10 years ago or 20 years ago. So the nucleus of the family is not the way it was once before. So it really does require a communal effort in terms of how we support these families. And it really is a communal effort in terms of educating these communities, making sure people are very aware of what is normal and what is not normal. Mm-hmm. When do I need to start having a conversation with my provider? And if I'm an individual, whether I'm Black, Brown, or otherwise, do I know what to do if I've made the decision to live alone in my home and in my community? And does my community know how to support me?
Is there any information or data that shows the difference between Black and Brown or people of color reaching out for help as opposed to white people or Caucasians or whatever asking and receiving help?
You know, there are some historical challenges related to trust within Black and Brown communities. They don't always ask for some of those resources that are related mm-hmm. to mental health or hospice. We see this disparity with hospice also. By the time that most Black and Brown working class folks ask for help, they are further down the trajectory of the disease process, and mm-hmm. which is very, very problematic. So it really behooves the healthcare practitioner to, one, develop a relationship with your patients, have open, candid conversations so that people feel comfortable with my doctor talking to me and bringing up these things that I may not bring up to my doctor, because in my culture, I may not even be aware that there's something wrong.
And what about the opportunity or the availability of care providers, especially in the rural areas? I know you service a lot of rural areas.
Rural areas, the level of support is just not there. One, the communities are very dense. The number of providers are not as prevalent. And as folks are aging in those rural communities, transportation becomes a significant barrier as well. The community lens and support is really crucial in those rural communities. It really becomes that rural communal village really has to step up and support older adults in those communities, because there are the ones who need to go and check on those folks. That neighbor to neighbor concept becomes really, really important. Faith mm-hmm. communities becomes extremely important in rural communities as well, to make sure that people have what they need to just to live comfortably every day, whether they have Alzheimer's or not.
Your families, your neighbors, and your church are probably the three main sources, I would assume, for a lot of those folks.
Absolutely. And one other area that can be really helpful in a rural community is the farmers market, because these are places where people go every day or every week, and you engage with people. And folks within the farmers market setting, they see their neighbors. They're going to be the first identifier that, hey, where is Mrs. Jones? We haven't seen her in a couple of weeks. Something may be going on. Or they may be the first ones to start to identify that this person is having some cognitive inconsistencies. There's something going on that they may want to bring to the surface of the family member or someone who might be able to support this individual. So the farmers markets and the small country store is another great identifiable place for folks who are having some difficulties.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, because I currently live in a very rural area and wouldn't have even considered that. So thank you so much for that information. So just a question, what is the history behind the Martha W. Goodson Center?
So the Martha W. Goodson Center, our name changed a year ago, and we adapted the name Martha W. Goodson to honor a significant donation given to Riverside by the Goodson family in honor of Martha Goodson, who is living with Alzheimer's disease. The Goodson family identified that as they were caring for Mr. Goodson, caring for his wife, he found it very difficult to access resources, know where to go for resources, and he wanted to ensure that no other family would have that difficulty or that struggle. Thus, the impetus for the significant donation, which changed our existing name from the Center for Excellence in Aging and Lifelong Health to the Martha W. Goodson Center. We are a full-service, comprehensive geriatric assessment clinic. We support older adults who have concerns related to aging, mobility, medication management, and many of those older adults have some concerns about cognitive changes that they have noticed. So the gift from the Goodson family really helped give us some wind underneath our existing wings to spread out and expand the work that we were already doing across our footprint. But also it gave us an opportunity to establish more prominence regarding how we support caregivers, making sure that caregivers and care partners not only know how to access services, but know when they need to start making some changes as they're getting older.
And I understand that the center, I'm just going to kind of go down a list of the things that they do. So they have senior navigators where a family member or the person or a caregiver can call and sort of get that process started if they do notice some cognitive changes.
Yes, and we call those folks memory care navigators, and they help people navigate. There is a senior navigation program as well, and those are folks who call just for general things related to aging. But the memory care navigator is a specialty where people can call, and they need support and or guidance. They went to the doctor. The doctor said, we think it's dementia, and you can come back and see us in a year. And the families are left with, what in the world do we do next? What do I do? Where do I go? Who do I call? Wow. Oftentimes, folks will call us and they will talk with one of our memory care navigators who will walk the journey with them, providing education, resources, coaching, and support for that caregiver, care partner, and oftentimes for the individual with the diagnosis, because depending on where they are on the trajectory of the disease process, they may be a person who is living alone and they're navigating this all on their own.
What a great model program. My goodness.
I mean, it's a great opportunity. And of the top 10 diseases that people die from in this country, of which Alzheimer's disease is up at number 3, mm-hmm. for older adults, it is the only one where navigational support is not automatic. If you were diagnosed with, you know, breast cancer, you would automatically be attached to a navigator who would walk with you. If you were diagnosed with end-stage renal failure, there would be somebody there mm-hmm. coaching you. Of those mm-hmm. top 10 diseases, this is the only one where a navigator is not automatically attached with your family to provide that coaching and that support. So kudos to Riverside for being very forward-thinking and putting a program like this in place.
Yeah, Jill and I both worked for Riverside for years, and one of the things that I'm proud of most is how forward-thinking they were.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it has anything to do, and I know there's also some disparity that women also have, I don't know what the percentages are, but typically suffer from dementia or different types of dementia. Men don't ask for directions. They're sure not going to ask for help. They're also, I think the worst horror stories we've heard are from the husbands or brothers or sons taking care of a female family member that, you know, they just didn't, like you said, they don't reach out for help until they're so desperate. It's hard to deal with.
It is hard to deal with. Almost 2/3 of Americans living with Alzheimer's disease are women. So women are disproportionately impacted by this disease. Not only are we more likely to be living with the disorder, we are most likely the caregivers of someone who also has the disorder. Where men, they don't get off the hook here because often husbands or sons will find themselves in the domestic seat of a caregiver. Many are very, very unprepared and unaware and caught off guard.
And uncomfortable.
They are uncomfortable, and many men are fixers. Mm-hmm. And you cannot fix this. And that is one of the things Mr. Goodson said, was he had to accept the fact that I cannot fix this. And I can't make it better. He said, and once he made the decision and the realization that I cannot fix this, he said, I've got to go and learn everything I can about it. I need to become empowered so that I can help support my wife, because I'm not going to be able to fix this and make this better.
What a wonderful, gracious way to handle it. I'm curious about, because of the disparity, and we have certainly learned over, you know, decades and decades, a lot of like clinical trials, they're very often geared towards men. Not that long ago, I think the medical field felt that we'll test all the men and the women are the same.
The majority of the time, it's middle-aged white men who participate in clinical trials. Mm-hmm. And the medications that are made, like Aricept, for example, it was modeled based on the middle-aged white man's DNA. So I have a friend who is a neuroscientist, and he always says, Tina, you know, we're all participating in clinical trials. And I was like, oh, Jonathan, tell me more. He said, well, every time you take a pill, that you've never taken before. Yeah. It's a test trial. They don't know if it's going to work for you or not. That's why we have allergic reactions and all these different things to medications, because they don't know. It's all a trial. So trying to encourage people to participate in clinical trials on the front end, as opposed to the back end, is important.
I think the poster child would be Don Talbot. And we've had a wonderful podcast with he and Christy. But the fact that they fought because of his age, he couldn't get into the clinical trial at Johns Hopkins, and they fought and they got him in. And he's still a miracle walking at 59 years old or whatever, when they told him at 43, you got a couple years left. Yeah, you're right. We're all guinea pigs, I guess.
You know, researchers, there has to be a significant amount of intentionality. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, depending on how much time and the bandwidth that the researchers have and the comfort that they have in certain communities, they do what I call is they go after the low-hanging fruit. They sort of cast a net, and it's, we're going to take whoever we get. Instead of being intentional about going into Native American communities and Asian communities and Latina and Black communities and communities with a higher prevalence of women, and educating and supporting and developing relationships so that they trust you and they will participate in your clinical trials. Whoa, that takes a lot of hard work. So rather than doing that, we're just going to take whoever we get and we'll test the others on the back end. That has been the approach for decades. Mm-hmm.
Does the funding have any part in this? You know, what they're required to offer the funding?
In the funding, there's always language that says that there must be a valiant effort to reaching out to all of these folks. And they will demonstrate probably that they tried, but we just couldn't get them. So we just kind of took what we had. So the language is always there. For ethical purposes, you have to widen the reach, but you can't force people to participate in clinical trials.
Is the Alzheimer's Association still, I know we went a few times to DC to you know, talk and meet with all the legislators, and this was years before, you know, and it did result in finally actually bumping up tremendously the amount of money that was funded towards this research. When, you know, I remember them saying that this is the disease that's going to ruin this country if you don't take some steps. Do you know if Alzheimer's is still dealing on the legislative side?
They are still the huge, largest champion for Alzheimer's research is the Alzheimer's Association. You know, prior to coming to Riverside, I worked for the Alzheimer's Association for 7 years, and it was a tremendous opportunity. And boy, did I learn a lot through the legislative lens, as well as some of these other disparities that I was unaware of when I was working in healthcare for so many years. So the Alzheimer's Association, they are still the largest champion for expanding what we call concern and awareness, helping the community become concerned. And when there is awareness, people have a large megaphone. And the larger the megaphone towards Congress, the more funding you have an opportunity to get.
I spoke with a nurse yesterday. I had to have a test done at the hospital. And she mentioned, we were talking about things that are going on. And I told her what my background a little bit. And she immediately started peppering me with questions because she and her husband are taking care of his brother, some dementia. It was just startling to me that an educated nurse working in the hospital system 20 some years, not aware.
You know, both you and I, you know, I thought taking care of my dad for 3 years, I knew what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I got this. No.
When you work in healthcare, often we get in our field of study or practice and we sort of dig our heels in and we become subject matter experts of that. And that's really what you want often. I really want I had a knee replacement. I really want my orthopedic surgeon to know really everything he needs to know about that. And that being said, I also want my primary care provider, who's looking at my whole body from a holistic perspective, to be really well versed on all those things that are impacting me today and those things that are going to impact me as I get older, and to engage me in a conversation. And often, if people don't hear it from their primary care provider, and my primary care provider doesn't seem to be concerned about my memory, so I must be doing okay, therein lies the problem. So the major challenge facing older adults now, I'm going to say older adults, anybody who's 45 and older, The major challenge is that you're not engaging your primary care provider in a dialogue that looks at you from a holistic perspective for where you are today and where you're going, not just what brought me into the doctor's office.
Yeah, even the primary cares are like specialists just in that very general area, but they don't always delve into what else is going on. I've had a lot of issues with health in the last few months. And every time I was at a doctor's office appointment with my husband, a lot of the times, the questions that were asked a number of times, do you feel safe in your home? And I'm thinking, well, if I didn't, guess who's sitting right next to me? As you think I'm going to answer this, like, honestly, like that, they're not asking the other questions about your memory and things that might, you know, do you have a concern about that? You know, I think everyone has a concern of that at some age. The first time you forget a name, you go, oh boy, here we go. We have to be more aware and just keep talking about it openly and question the doctors.
Absolutely. And we're doing better because, you know, those social determinant and safety questions that you just talked about, those I was not getting asked those questions pre-COVID, but COVID taught us that there are some things going on in our homes. Now that folks were, you know, sort of in the homes together, they realized, there are some safety issues. So I noticed those questions starting to show up post-COVID. Mm-hmm. So we continue to rally healthcare organizations to ask those questions and to ask them in a different way. If you were to ask, you know, my husband, do you have concerns with your memory or do you need a caregiver? He's going to say no. But if you were to ask me, my doctor would ask me during my annual wellness exam or my yearly checkup, are you providing care or support for someone with memory concerns or memory changes? I would say yes.
Yeah. And I know, Marty, and we've talked about this before on other podcasts. One of the things we've always talked about in caregiver support groups, encouraging the caregiver to write a list of questions or call the doctor's office ahead of time or ask for 5 minutes alone, you know, that so they can get the real story out.
Yes. Right. And what we really are encouraging, you know, caregivers or care partners or care supporters or someone who's living with, because some people don't even identify as such, is to go public with the fact that I am living with or I am supporting someone who has some medical conditions. It's important for my doctor to know I'm doing that because if my blood pressure starts going through the roof or my levels are starting to change, my doctor needs to know that I may be living in a situation that may be causing me some, you know, additional stress.
And that kind of leads me into the center actually has a learning center and workshops available at the Martha W. Goodson Center.
Yes, Martha W. Goodson Center. We opened in January a brand new caregiver education center. The only one on the entire East Coast where a space is dedicated for caregivers and care partners to come to learn information, to get skills building, but also to have a good time. One of the classes that we have right now is a community sing-along choir for persons living with Parkinson's disease. And it really is, and it's led by a speech therapist. So it's to really help with that vocal strengthening and enunciation. But the focus is on these caregivers, empowering them with all the things that they need. And often it's things that they are not even aware that they need. So it's new. There's opportunities to learn about dementia, Alzheimer's, medication reconciliation. There will be a class on Tai Chi and mindfulness. So looking at the full person and trying to help a person become empowered to not only support the person that they're loving and caring for, but also to care for themselves in the process.
Absolutely. And I know you mentioned in talking before this, the Blue Zone opportunities. And I think one of the main focuses on Blue Zone and why those folks seem to be doing so well is a community. It's all part of what you're just saying is everyone, you have to broaden your network, reach out, tell everybody, tell your neighbors, tell the police, you know, notify folks just to be aware. And again, we told a funny story about Don Talbot, who decided he was going to go mow the lawn and he went off on the John Deere and Christy got 4 phone calls within an hour. We just saw Don go by. he's mowing lawns today. He's okay. I've only had one caregiver in all these years that said she wished she had never done that because she felt afterwards that she was ostracized by her neighbors. And I thought how very sad that they didn't step up when they could have. I think that's the exception to the rule. It's usually very smart to let everybody know.
It's important to let everyone know, uh-huh. or as many people as possible that you trust, because if there's an incident at your home, the police department, they need to have an awareness, because hopefully they've gotten some training so that when they come, they can adjust their approach so that it doesn't become an even more horrific event. So that your neighbors, if they see you exit the home at 2 o'clock in the morning, they have a heightened alertness or awareness. Yes. You know, they're not spying on you, but they're helping you to do the thing you want to do most, which is live in your neighborhood and in your community. And yes. if you're going to have a cognitive impairment, people need to know. The same way we do for most people do if they have a child with special needs or who mm-hmm. learns differently, you put people on alert so that they can help yes. the individual stay safe. The downside of that is community is so different than what it was when I was a kid. When yeah. I was a kid, I knew every person in every house on our block, even even our older adults, we knew everyone. And yes. now, you know, my neighbors, I couldn't tell you my neighbor's first and last name. I only yes. see them coming and going. So community is different. Very. So if you're an older adult, and if you are a person who has special needs or some medical conditions, you have to recreate what that communal support is and what mm-hmm. that communal support is going to look like.
I think that the uh-huh. difference is it used to be offered. Now you have to ask. And usually when you ask, it will generously be offered, but you kind of have to ask.
Yes.
You know, you talked a little bit about the Blue Zone and those Blue Zone opportunities. Some people think, what the heck is that? What is Blue Zone? you know, National Geographic did the survey and they wanted to take a look to see, how come some folks in certain parts of the world are living so long and such healthy lives? And they zoned it down to these 9 key principles, and they identify them as the Blue Zones, different parts of the world. There are 6 of them, 5 of them, places that are identified as these Blue Zones where folks live the longest. But there are 9 key principles, and one of those principles is called having the right tribe, surrounding yourself with people who support positive behaviors, and they're in your network and they help you live your absolute best life. Mm-hmm. Often people find that in their faith community. And yes. your faith community does not necessarily mean it has to be a church. Some people are, they go to the Unitarian Church, or mm-hmm. their faith community, you know, could be their lodge. Mm-hmm. It's having a community where you have a sense of belonging, where you can connect with those folks who become your tribe, and they help you live your best life. All the things we talked about, one of the things I think is most important, and is that message that I often try to get out to folks, is aging requires having a plan, and aging well requires having a plan. And the most important element to the aging plan is the relationship that you have with your healthcare provider. If you're in a relationship with your healthcare provider and you don't feel comfortable sharing something, and you don't feel like it is an open dialogue, I always encourage folks, look for a different provider. There are other providers that yes. are out there.
Yes.
So you need a provider where you can be absolutely open and honest, mm-hmm. and your provider is open and honest with you, and they respect whatever your wishes are. So a couple of things I want folks to consider. One, have a provider you can trust. Very important. Mm-hmm. Number two, ask your provider, make sure that they're doing a yearly cognitive assessment so that you have a baseline, so that if something changes year over year, they have some comparative data to go back and take a look at. Mm-hmm. So not just going in for your annual wellness exam and my physical checkup. Nope, I want the cognitive assessment.
I would have never thought to ask for that, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and actually,
I thought that my doctor would even want to, well, my doctor's great, but
yeah,
you know, I wouldn't think that a doctor would even, you know, want to consider that.
And often in your provider's office, it's, you know, they ask me a question, I give them an answer. So it's difficult to pick up from that perspective. So having the cognitive assessment yes. can help them really explore different parts of my thought process.
Yep.
Communicate with your provider, communicate with your family, if you have a family, or the family that you create. Mm-hmm. Communicate with someone in your faith community. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you have a lawyer, communicate with your yes. lawyer. And then communicate with your local law enforcement. Make sure that they have it on record that you're caring for someone in your home with a cognitive impairment. And then lastly, this is really crucial. Make sure on your medical records, it not only identifies, you know, the next of kin. That's one thing. But who can I share information with? Who can your doctor not only talk to, but who can they give information to, like the medical records? These are different documents. Often people think, well, I put my wife down as the next of kin. Yes, but it doesn't say I can talk to her. And it doesn't say I can give documents to her. So you want to make sure, list the next of kin. Who can we talk to? Who can we share physical documents with? Because that might be needed up the road.
Absolutely. And the talking to the lawyer, making sure you have the right people in place to provide the services and talk to the people before you give them an assignment.
Yeah. Finding out at the last minute, oh, I'm in charge of this?
I'm in charge of that now. Yeah, very important. And some people, they retire and they don't have anyone. And in that instance, I say reach out to your local area agency on aging. There's an area agency on aging that supports every county in the United States. They have case managers who can offer you some support at no cost that can help you put an effective plan in place for aging and for unexpected illnesses.
That's what I talked to the nurse about yesterday. I said, there are advocates. You got to reach out and find them. So,
well, thank you both for all that you do and for how you're empowering folks in the community to just live their best lives. And I think that if folks have a little bit of information, they can do it.
Yes, ma'am. Dr. Thomas, thank you so much for spending time with us. And we're definitely going to put you on our guest list again.
Well, no problem. Yes. And thank you for what you're doing, particularly how you're reaching those folks out in those also critical rural communities.
Well, we just really appreciate it. And there's so many more questions I have for you. We definitely have to do this again.
Absolutely, for sure. 'Cause I'm gonna make this
place yours. If you or someone you know is caring for others, please feel free to share this podcast with them. You can listen online at wwer.org.
Please send questions, concerns, or suggestions for future topics to our email, carepartners@wwer.org.
If you enjoy the programming on WWER, please consider making a donation. You can find out more at wwer.org/membership.